In his new book, The Negotiator, a memoir, former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell looks back at his eclectic career in politics, law, and business, reflecting on his experience and valuable lessons that he's learned. Mitchell tells his favorite stories about growing up in Maine, his half century of politics, both domestic and international, and how we achieve our goals through negotiation and compromise. Again, the name of the book is The Negotiator. It's a great pleasure to welcome George Mitchell to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think makes a good negotiator?
Well, it depends on the circumstances, of course, because the negotiations take many different forms. Trying to end a conflict like the one in Northern Ireland or the Middle East is different from trying to resolve a financial dispute between two companies. But overall, I think patience, perseverance, a willingness to listen carefully to all sides, including those that you don't think much of or that you disagree with, I think those qualities are necessary. And, of course, essentially a knowledge of the issues to the extent possible.
Was it always possible for you to walk in with a blank slate as far as your feelings and your thoughts on a particular subject?
I had been a federal judge before I entered the Senate, and then I served for 6 years as Senate Majority Leader. So I'd had a fairly considerable experience in resolving disputes and setting aside, to the extent humanly possible, my own personal biases. So when I went to Northern Ireland, I felt I could do that, but there was a lot of opposition to me based upon precisely the question that you've asked. He's a Democrat, he's an American, he's a Catholic. All of these were considered as creating biases within me. Although I didn't realize that at the time, and I didn't appreciate the length of time I took, I chaired three separate sets of discussions over a five-year period. As it turns out, that helped me, because over that very long period of time, I had to make dozens, hundreds of decisions, and I was able to demonstrate to the satisfaction of all sides that I could make them in a reasonably fair and impartial manner. So by the end, we were all friends. Then those who had initially opposed me became and remain personal friends to this day.
And when it comes to trust, which is something that you have to build, that obviously takes time, and sometimes you have more time than others.
That depends upon the nature of the conflict, which, of course, you don't control. In Northern Ireland, for example, the main negotiation lasted about 2 years. But for most of that time, there was little or no progress. Finally, in desperation, I sought the approval of and got the approval of the parties to establish a final unbreakable deadline in desperation, because there had been a highly publicized assassination a few months earlier that had set off a round of back-and-forth killings and bombings, and the whole process was disintegrating, and I was certain it would end in a renewal of conflict if we didn't do something. So I set a deadline, and fortunately we got an agreement just at the last minute before that deadline fully expired. So it depends upon the individual circumstances how you approach bringing it to a conclusion.
When it comes to Northern Ireland, is there a point where, even if there is some negotiation, through negotiation, that an accord is reached, but there's always still work to do well beyond that, as we see in that situation. So how do you make your work somewhat finite and a building block for future negotiations?
When I announced the Good Friday Agreement on April 10th, 1998, that day and the following several days, when I was interviewed dozens, probably hundreds of times, I made clear that by itself, the agreement did not guarantee peace, stability, and reconciliation. It did make them possible, but there would be many decisions down the road. It represented a political compromise, the best that could be reached at that time, and it did succeed in the very important task of bringing nearly to an end the violence that had plagued the society for decades before. But even within the agreement, there was recognition that it wasn't final. Some issues we simply couldn't resolve, so we created new commissions and gave them new mandates and a couple of years to come up with answers to issues like policing and the justice system. So I think what you have to do is avoid saying that you have to have a perfect, airtight agreement that satisfactorily answers every question. That's probably unattainable in most conflicts involving human beings. The best you can do is get, in this case, it proved to be enough to stop the violence, establish democratic, nonviolent procedures for resolving their differences. We didn't make the differences disappear, and it remains a segregated society with a lot of issues and a lot of problems, but they're trying to deal with them by debate rather than through guns and bullets, and that's a significant step forward.
You write about this in the book, but what is it like for you to return to Northern Ireland now?
It's a wonderful feeling. I'm an American, proud of it, always will be, but a large part of my heart and emotions always will be in Northern Ireland. I spent so much time there, came to know so many people, witnessed so many funerals, so much death and destruction and grief and sorrow that my heart ached for them when times were bad, and I'm happy for them when times are good. They're wonderful people. They are quarrelsome. They're very quick to take offense, but they're also warm and energetic, very productive, and a great place to be, great for the people who live there, and I go back just as often as I can.
You write in the book about your many experiences as a negotiator of when you are called in. I'm curious, and you briefly mentioned this, but I'm curious as to what you turn down. What doesn't reach your standard of saying, okay, I want to get involved in this?
Well, time is a factor. I'm a full-time practicing lawyer. I was for a long time the chairman of the law firm with which I'm associated, which is a very large firm, DLA Piper, with offices all over the world. So I simply can't do everything I'm asked to do, and I turn down quite a large number based upon that. The second factor restraining me now is that I was married when I left the Senate, and I had children late in life. So I have two teenage children, and that's a job full-time and a half for me and my wife, as every one of your listeners who has children knows. And so I turn down some that will require being away from home. I couldn't do now what I did in Northern Ireland because I was away for long stretches at a time. It was then just my wife and I, and she's a terrific, independent, self-supporting person, and she encouraged me to go, although, you know, we were apart quite a bit. But once you have children, your life changes. So those are some of the factors that affect me now in terms of accepting or rejecting projects. I still do some traveling, but not as much as I used to.
Let us talk about President Obama asking you to be a United States Special Envoy for Middle East peace. This three-year commitment, what was it that made you say yes, and what did you think was achievable there?
Well, I think I'm very lucky to be an American, to live in what, despite our country's many serious imperfections, still is the most open, the most free society in all of human history. My mother was an immigrant, couldn't read or write English, spent her entire life working nights in textile mills. My father was the orphan son of immigrants. He left school after the fourth grade. He was a janitor. And here I became the majority leader of the U.S. Senate, thanks to this great and open and free country. And so I have a belief that any American who's called upon to serve his country or her country ought to do so. I have to tell you, I made this clear in the book. I served in the Army. I thought it was one of the greatest things I've ever done. I enjoyed it. I think I grew up in the Army. I learned good values of teamwork and coordination and patriotism. And so when the president asked me, there was no doubt in my mind it would say yes. But I simply had to condition it in terms of time for the reasons I stated a little bit earlier, that is, the personal reasons. But I didn't even take into account the fact that I knew the chances of getting an agreement were very low. After all, we've had 12 presidents and 20 secretaries of state in 65 years who've been trying to resolve it. So the notion that I could go and solve it quickly was, of course, completely unrealistic. So I knew there wasn't much chance, but I felt if the president asks you to take a task on and you think it's helpful serving your country, you should do so.
You do say in the book that it was clear to you that the past failures to achieve peace do not make failure inevitable.
That's right. I believe there's no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. They're conducted by humans. They can be ended by humans. And I think that will be true of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as well in time.
So I guess that's the big question, right, of time, and how much time does it take, and at what point do people say, okay, we're ready to address this?
One can never know for sure in advance, although they're quite different. Think of the fact that in Northern Ireland, a week before we got the agreement, a public opinion poll was published which reported that 80% of the people felt no agreement was possible. Only 7% thought an agreement was possible. 10% or so had no opinion. It was over 80%. So it's very difficult to know in advance. What you have to do is to go in and do the very best you can and hope that the timing works out. In the Middle East, it's more complicated than Northern Ireland because there are so many external factors, so many intersecting, overlapping, sometimes contradictory conflicts going on, engulfing the region that have an impact on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and vice versa. Now, so the timing wasn't right, and the leaders at this time, Netanyahu and Abbas, don't trust each other, so that's another factor. But in time, I think both societies will recognize that a resolution of their conflict is in their interest. It isn't just charity toward the other side. It's in each of their interests. President George W. Bush gave a speech in Jerusalem on January 9, 2009, 11 days before he left office, in which he set forth American policy and the rationale for it. And I commend it to anyone. I didn't agree with everything President Bush did or said even in that speech, but it sets forth in passages a very powerful rationale for why it's in Israel's interest that there be a Palestinian state, and it's in the Palestinians' interest that there be safety, security for the people of Israel.
George Mitchell is our guest. The name of the new book is The Negotiator. It is published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation with Senator Mitchell after this short break. George Mitchell served as Democratic Senator from the state of Maine from 1980 to 1995 and Senate Majority Leader from 1989 to 1995. He was the primary architect of the 1998 Good Friday Agreement for Peace in Northern Ireland, chairman of the Walt Disney Company, U.S. Special Envoy for the Middle East Peace, and the author of The Mitchell Report on the use of performance-enhancing drugs in baseball. He was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1999. His new book is The Negotiator. It is published by Simon & Schuster, and it is a pleasure to have him on the roundtable this morning. Let us talk a little bit about baseball and the call you got and at what state the game was in when you were brought in to try to clean up America's pastime.
It was in the spring of 2006 when the commissioner of baseball, then Bud Selig, called me and asked if I would conduct an investigation into the use of performance-enhancing drugs in Major League Baseball. I had served on what was called the Blue Ribbon Commission on the Economics of Baseball 6 years earlier, along with others, and our report had served as a basis for the agreement between the baseball players and the clubs, the first one in over 20 years that avoided a work stoppage. And so the commissioner felt that I could try to do the same thing in this area. I told him I would accept, provided I had complete independence and could follow the evidence wherever it led and would report what I found, no matter what it was. Of course, I couldn't know at that time. To his great credit, the commissioner agreed and followed through on that agreement and promise. Commissioner Selig to this day is the only commissioner of any major professional sport who has authorized a completely independent investigation of that sport and its drug use. And what I found, of course, was that there had been an enormous amount of publicity, criticism, about the use of drugs in baseball. A few of the players who used drugs after they retired admitted it, and that cast a cloud. There was a book that had been written by two reporters in San Francisco, and so I would say that there was a lot of turmoil and controversy. I couldn't resolve all the issues because the players and the Players Association refused to cooperate. None of them would talk to me or give me any documents. They had opposed the testing for a long period of time, but I will say now, to their great credit, the players have taken another position. They've reviewed it, and they've concluded that a support for a strong program is in their interest. The fact is, as I tried to argue, that the principal victims of steroid use by some baseball players are those who don't use steroids or other drugs. And so the majority of players who don't use drugs who are being adversely affected, their livelihoods being cut short. So the report, which got mostly publicized by the names in it, in fact, was most important for the recommendations that were accepted by the players and the clubs, which now make baseball's the strongest drug program of any sport.
Reading this book, if we play that game of which one of these doesn't belong, it seems as though the outlier to your career was your time at Disney. Did you feel that way, that it was just something completely different?
Well, in a sense, yes. I'd never been involved in the entertainment industry, and I'd never been chairman of the board of a major company, so it was different. But in the end, most disputes involve personal relationships, leadership, being able to act in a fair and consistent manner, and to be persuasive to those whose actions you're trying to influence, whether they're employees or delegates at a talk or negotiation or the public when you're in a political campaign. So it was, for me, a difficult period when I served as chairman during the transition of leadership, but I was on that board for 12 years, and it was one of the best experiences of my life. It's a great company, way over 150,000 employees, and all of them very dedicated and committed to the company, really an international icon. And I'm very pleased that they're doing now phenomenally well, expanding, growing, and providing entertainment for, I guess you could say, billions of people worldwide now. So I enjoyed the experience. It was different from what I'd done before or since, but it was interesting, and although at times difficult, in the end, worth the effort.
Do you understand what happens within an organization that can cause that situation? You came in at the point when Michael Eisner, the longtime CEO of the company, was on the ropes. He had a lot of people who were criticizing him, and the criticism was mounting.
Well, when you get down to it, really, it's basically pretty simple. When the company was doing well, he was being praised. When the company's economic fortune turned for a variety of reasons, he got the criticism. That's human nature. It's true in every business enterprise, or really almost any human endeavor. So it is true that the company's earnings went flat for a few years, and they couldn't maintain the pace of growth that they had. But during Michael Eisner's tenure, the value of the stock rose 870%. So there was a substantial period of growth, success, value, and then accountability when that stopped, and there were a few years of flat earnings. Fortunately, the growth has resumed. Michael did a great job for the time he was there. He was the right guy, certainly, to bring the company back from its earlier misfortunes. And Bob Iger has done a tremendous job of following him and bringing the company to even new and higher record levels.
I would like to talk to you, as we wrap up our conversation, a little bit about your, obviously, politics and your political career. How would you, do you think, fare in the U.S. Senate now?
It's a pretty tough place now. I think everybody ought to recognize that there has never been a period in American life when politics was all sunshine and happiness without any discord or difficulty. Going all the way back to the beginning of our country, a professor at the University of Maine recently wrote an article on the presidential campaign of 1800. Two men who are now national icons, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, opposed each other, and it was a very nasty campaign. The difference, of course, is they didn't have radio and television and negative ads and billions of dollars in campaigns, so it didn't have the effect, the negativism didn't have the effect that it has now. I thought it was tough when I was there, although I got along very well with Bob Dole, the Republican leader. We were and are great friends to this day. We never had a harsh personal word passed between us, although we disagreed often. But I think it has become much tougher now, much more difficult, and I think much more unpleasant for the senators themselves. I have a feeling that this year, this Congress, you may see the beginnings of a little turnaround in the Senate, maybe a little more cooperation across party lines. One of the ironies of the current trade bill being discussed is that there are some Republicans for it, some Democrats, more Republicans than Democrats for it, but nonetheless split, and the opposition is split, more Democrats and some Republicans. So you're beginning to see issues decided not exclusively on party lines, but on the substance of the issues themselves. And I hope that continues and expands.
As you said, there was really never a time where it was, you know, a completely clean game and all sunshine and roses. However, we are at a time where the perception by the American people, often I think an accurate perception, is that not a lot is getting done. There's great gridlock, and there is a lot of sniping back and forth and no real action. So I obviously, and you write about this, but you saw your share of that as well. But going back to just the nature of what you're writing about in this book of negotiation, of that want, that desire to sit down and try to iron something out, that often seems to be missing.
I think it is. I think there is much less of that now, and that's a bad thing. It's a sad thing. I'm not a political scientist, but I can point to a couple of factors that I think contribute to that. The first is that because of the use of technology, congressional redistricting is now refined to a point that didn't previously exist in our history. One consequence of that is that people know right now which party will win about four-fifths of the seats in the House of Representatives next year. They may not know the individual, but they know these are Republican seats, these are Democratic seats. That's because the pivotal moment in American politics has moved in the House of Representatives from the general election to the primary election. very few people participate in our political process. As you know, even in hotly contested presidential elections, we just barely pass 50%, sometimes get close to 60, but that's it. In congressional elections in the midterm, they're much, much fewer than that. So what that means is that the most rigid, ideological, strident groups in each party have a hugely disproportionate influence in the nominating process, and that's what controls the outcome of the election because of redistricting and because of the insane and obscene amount of money that is poured into our political system on a constant basis. There's always been money in politics. That's true throughout human history. But what's happening now, I think, is very dangerous. Here's the reason. It has destroyed the trust of the American people in their congressional representatives. I speak all over America, and I ask every audience, elderly, youth, business, labor, do you believe that members of Congress are more responsive to the needs of their constituents than they are to their donors? And the thousands and thousands of people of whom I've asked that question, only one hand has ever been risen, has ever shot up in the air. And I was so surprised, I went and asked the woman afterward who raised her hand. I said to her, you're the only person in all of America who's ever raised her hand. And I said, can you explain it? She said, it's simple. My husband's a member of Congress. That's the only person who's ever said that congressmen are more responsive to their constituents and their donors. That's a very bad thing for a democratic society. And this money chase is terrible. It takes so much time. It's such an intrusion on the process and on an effective functioning democracy. So I think those are some of the reasons why you're seeing what exists now.
Okay, so when you're reading the book, I found it hard to read and not feel that you have a certain level of optimism on many fronts. So in this case, where does your optimism lie that we can change that and that more hands will go up in the air in the future?
There is a movement underway in about 15 states now to reduce the degree of partisanship in the process of redistricting. As you know, it occurs every 10 years after the census. The issue is now being tested in the Supreme Court. I hope very much that the movement, which originated in Iowa and California, will spread to all 50 states, and the process of redistricting will be restored to what it should be, that is nonpartisan, simply to guarantee that the number of voters in each congressional district is roughly the same, rather than beginning with a desired partisan outcome and working backward from there. That's the hugely important step. Secondly, I think if we can reduce the amount of money by providing reasonable restraints, the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court will go down in history as one of the worst decisions of any Supreme Court in all of American history. The Supreme Court didn't create the problem. There's always been a problem of money in politics, but they essentially poured gasoline on the fire by making it easier for these enormous sums to be contributed and to reduce transparency. It's now not intended by the court, but it's a fact that it's less transparent now than it was 10 or 20 years ago. If we can make those, I think, modest and realistic changes, I think you'll start to see the pendulum swing the other way.
Senator George Mitchell is the author of the book, The Negotiator, Reflections on an American Life, from Maine to the U.S. Senate, from baseball to Disney, from Northern Ireland to the Middle East. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Senator Mitchell, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thanks for having me.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, George Mitchell is the author of The Negotiator. It's published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.